Well, welcome back, everyone, to the Whitetail Theories podcast. Today on the mic, we got special guest Adam Reeder. And today we're going to be talking about kind of the nuances and idiocracies of hunting. So welcome to the podcast, Adam. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Hanging in there. Busy week for me. So let's just do our basic introduction. Why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself, where you're from, how you got into hunting, that whole gamut there.
Sounds good. Yeah, my name's Adam Reeder. I'm actually from Allendale, Michigan. I grew up hunting. I really started showing interest in it when I was about 10 years old. My dad never really hunted. My uncles and my grandpa hunted, but my dad wasn't super into it. And then when I showed interest in it, my dad got a bow and got a bow donated to him for me to use from one of his friends. And I basically that's where I started hunting. Me and my dad kind of learning along the way. And just basically 100% from scratch. I was self-taught on a lot of things. I spent days and days with my face in books, magazines, anything I could read, watch, anything sort of kind of along those lines. I was in it, and I was reading all the time, just constantly learning, trying to do what I could to kill my first deer. And my dad and I kind of learned on public land, and yeah, that's basically how it started.
But so you are the second guest now that got into hunting through kind of like the same exact thing, where the kid wanted to hunt and then the dad had no hunting background and they went down that journey together. So I find that very interesting because it's not your typical grandfather taking you out and getting started hunting, or your father getting you out and get you started hunting. What were some of the trials and tribulations that you went through with your father, like getting into hunting, as far as like success, learning? Because you said your uncle's hunt, so I'm sure that helped cut the learning curve a little bit, right? It's not like you didn't have any type of hunting experience, correct?
Yeah, my uncle's hunt, my grandpa hunted and still does. And so there was some guidance there from all of the above. And I actually really started getting into hunting because my buddy, he and his dad, he grew up hunting. His dad hunted his whole life. And I was in second grade, and I remember going over there, and we were just shooting birds and squirrels with BB guns. And I was like, I want to get a bow, and I want to try and shoot a deer. And that's basically where it all began. And it was definitely not easy off the bat, especially being in Michigan on public land. I'm in Michigan has three different zones that are kind of split up the state as far as tags go and stuff like that. And I'm in zone three, which is the highest population and the least amount of public land and the highest pressure. And so it was very difficult getting out there and finding spots where we weren't necessarily crowded out by other hunters. And that really kind of drove me to try and become the best that I could be and have that mentality that I have to get away from other people in order to find these deer, because they're so pressured that very difficult to hunt spooky deer. And I mean, from October 1 all the way till the end of the season, there's just guys everywhere and there's human scent in the woods everywhere. So I really had to do my research and my reading, and my dad did the same, and we just basically went out there and did the best that we could. And we struggled for the first couple years at finding deer and finding places. And then it started to kind of fall into place where we would find some deer, and I was a very jittery young hunter. I missed several deer my first few years, but I wouldn't pick up a gun until I killed them with my bow.
Wow.
And I learned the hard way without having a rangefinder or anything, and just basically guessing and guessing what pin to use. And it came back around and bit me a few times where I missed a fairly decent 8-point for state land. I mean, in my younger age, I thought it was a decent 8-point. It was a year and a half old, probably 12-inch wide basket rack. But he definitely got me pumped, and I cried that night. I'm not going to lie. But yeah, I was probably 11 when that happened.
And, wow.
Yeah, those failures just pushed me to do better next time. And it's that drive has definitely helped me come a long way as far as going after the quality of bucks that I look for now. And I still hunt a lot of public land. I have some private that I got permission on, but I would say probably 80% of my year is spent on public land.
So let me stop you there and let's kind of rewind here a little bit. So what was the aha moment for you when you guys started finding deer on public land? Like, I know originally you had mentioned that you needed to get away from pressure. So were you guys just going in as deep as possible, or were there certain things that you started to key in on that was helping you locate deer?
We were finding that it didn't necessarily have to be as deep as possible. It had to be as nasty as possible. We weren't finding as many people or as much litter or boot tracks in the woods when we would get into those nasty thick spots where sometimes we had to crawl or just tooth and nail fight our way through the underbrush to get to maybe even a 10 to 15 yard opening that we could get a tree stand in. And those areas where people would overlook and people would skip, because it was a lot of work to get in there. Even if it was 50 yards from the parking area, it was still a lot of work to get in there. It was where we were finding that the deer would kind of funnel to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very similar here in PA. The harder it is to get to as far as harder to access, thickness, the better it seems as far as the deer population and deer quality.
Yeah, I definitely would agree with that.
And the weird thing is too, so did you notice then that then as compared to now, the cool thing to do is get in as deep as possible. And in my opinion, getting in as deep as possible doesn't really matter, because anybody can really walk 4 miles, 3 miles, whatever, and get back in. But it matters as far as the security cover and how thick that is. Not everybody's doing that. You know, does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And I would agree with what you said as far as anybody can walk deep. Anybody can go far and get into those deep places. But not everybody can read deer sign and read the terrain and naturally kind of see where these deer are going to funnel to, versus somebody that can walk back there and just climb up a tree and hope for the best.
Right. Exactly. So my second question was, after the aha moment and you started getting on deer, you had those misses. What kept you going? Because I know a lot of times it's that's a lot to go through, especially as a young and new hunter-ish. That's a lot to go through, and not a lot of people make it through that.
Oh, really? Kind of what kept me going was people telling me to keep my head up and to basically, your general things that you're going to tell a young kid that is down on his luck, keep your head up, keep trying. You'll get there one day. And I didn't want to hear that you'll get there one day. I wanted to hear that congratulations and get that hug and the pat on the back or whatever and kill a deer. And I also highly considered picking up a firearm and trying to kill my first deer with a gun. But being stubborn, I watched that same buddy that kind of introduced me to hunting. I watched him kill his first deer with a gun, and he was very, very hard pressed about wanting to kill one with a bow first. And I wanted to stick to my guns on basically what I said I wanted to do.
So you would say that you're very stubborn and very goal oriented.
Yeah. That bit of stubbornness really, really pushed me into the mindset that I have to do this, and I don't like failing, and I'm a very goal oriented person, like you said, and once I set those goals, I want to be the best I can at whatever I'm doing at that moment. And at that moment, I wanted to kill a deer with my bow, and that's what I set out to do.
Well, now let me ask you this: how do you look at hunting as far as your general outlook? Like, some people look at it as a hobby, some people look at it as a way to get away from their daily life, whether that's their wife, whether that's a job, whether that's just the day-to-day stuff that they go through, like a stress reliever. Some people take it extremely serious, and it's a passion that they want to take it to the highest level that they can take it. Where do you kind of fall in that spectrum?
I definitely would consider myself as the passionate one. I basically eat, sleep, and breathe deer hunting. Deer season never really ends for me. Even after season ends, I'm constantly out there. I'm scouting postseason, preseason, finding the habitat and trying to really learn why deer do what they do and where they are doing these things. So yeah, I would definitely say that hunting is a passion for me, and that's kind of how it always has been, especially after I got that first deer with my bow and I started getting a few deer here and there, that just further fueled the fire.
Gotcha. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of similar how it was for me. Now, we're kind of starting to get into the meat and potatoes of really what I wanted this podcast to be about. But for my guests, I always want to ask, because I find it very interesting, what is something that you know now that you wish you would have known 10 years ago about hunting?
Oh, that's a very good question. And that could definitely push me down a rabbit hole of conversation. But I'd say a good generalization for like what I know now versus what I knew then was really to pay attention to deer's body language as they are coming in range, as they are walking through the woods. Because it's very, very obvious if you can tell when a deer is relaxed or when a deer is high strung, or you can really see deer's body language in the woods. And I really think that is a very important thing for a lot of hunters to know and to really pay attention to, because it can kind of key into so many other things that could follow once you see those deer.
Like what?
It could key into whether or not this deer has been chased by a buck, or whether or not there's more deer coming, or whether there's danger in the area. Usually you can tell if they just snuck out of a bedding area because another hunter approached. You can tell a lot of things by a deer's body language.
Yeah, I thought that was important for you to get that in there, because I knew what you were getting at, and I know exactly what you mean. For the listeners that potentially don't or in a still in that kind of like learning stage of figuring it out, I think it's really good for them to hear that, because it does tell you a lot of things about the surroundings and what's occurring in the woods that you potentially don't see. And then you read those context clues and it lets you know.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So that's very interesting, and it's something that really, really, I definitely think gets overlooked. But it's also really hard too. Like, I know you said you didn't want to go down a rabbit hole. They're actually one of my favorite things, but you don't know what you don't know. So, like, let's say, like, you're a new hunter, an intermediate hunter. Unless you're getting a lot of interactions with deer, how do you start picking up on that stuff? Because I feel like it's one of those things where it's something that the only way you learn it is from experience.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I guess kind of what I was getting at was I wish that I had known to pay attention to those more often. Gotcha. With deer encounters when I was young.
Gotcha. That's a really good point. Yeah, that's a really good point. All right, so let's dive into the meat and potatoes of the podcast. I think we kind of got the introduction well taken care of. So we really want to talk about kind of the nuances, if you will, if that's even the right terminology, but the misleading of new hunters getting into hunting. And we're talking more so like the public land hunters, the people that are out there grinding it out against hunting pressure. So Adam and I, kind of just to paint the background story of how this whole podcast started, we were going back and forth on Instagram, and one of the big things that I brought up and I kind of have a gripe with is that you see people like Joe Rogan and Steve Rinella with Meat Eater getting all these new hunters into hunting, and specifically people that don't have any type of background in hunting. So no mentors, no nothing. And they see hunting as like this glamorous, beautiful thing to get into where they can source their own meat, they can be one with nature, so on and so forth, which it is all those things. But they get them into hunting, and then like it's like, that's it. They wash their hands of it, and you're on your own. Well, recently, I had a discussion with a gentleman. The reason he got into hunting was because of a Joe Rogan podcast, and he couldn't tell you what a deer track looked like. That's how much inexperience he had. So, like, for me, what is the point of getting all these new people into hunting if, more than likely, if they don't have an attitude like Adam, they're going to quit within the first 2 years after have spent thousands of dollars getting gear, buying licenses, fuel to get there, so on and so forth. And when it comes time to vote or make a decision about a hunting law in your state, that person no longer cares about hunting, potentially is even going to vote in a negative manner. So, like, I in my opinion, I think they're doing somewhat of a disservice to hunters and hunting. So, Adam, take it away and give kind of your spiel on how we went about this, because I found your side very interesting as well.
Yeah, I can definitely see where you're coming from with the disservice and the dissatisfaction of somebody that goes out there and spends thousands of dollars on deer potentially, and then they go out hunting and they are dissatisfied with their experience because they literally know nothing. That definitely comes down to having somebody that, I mean, they don't have a mentor, like you said. And if they don't have a mentor, that can definitely negatively impact their experience. But I feel like anybody that feels the want to get into it after hearing a Joe Rogan podcast or something like that, I feel like it's almost irresponsible to not do your homework and kind of know what you're getting into. So that way you can at least have the proper mindset when you go into the woods that this stuff is not easy. Like, you're not just going to go out there and be a rock star. You got to have the mental capacity and you have to have the drive to actually want it. As far as that goes.
Let me interrupt you there real quick, Adam. Yeah. So do you think that hunting is painted in a picture that makes it look easy or makes it look hard?
I think that there's a lot of people that can unknowingly tune into a podcast like that and hear about it and hear about the per se, the glory of it, and hear about the aftermath of the hunt and the kill, and think that, oh, I'm just going to go out and kill a deer. Like, I feel like it's definitely, in some aspects, painted in a picture to look easy and look glorious almost. When, I mean, in reality, it's the opposite.
Okay, so we agree there. Like, I think even with, like, videography and stuff, a lot of times, well, I shouldn't say a lot of times, there's very few people in the industry that are painting it in a way that it makes it look as hard as it is. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
So, anyway, go on.
Oh, where was I? Yeah, I definitely think that those guys that go out there and end up in that position where they realize the amount of grit that it takes and then they hang it up could be a negative light to other people that could possibly want to get into hunting. Like, they can share their bad experience and dissuade other people, or like you said, they may not bring it up to other people, and when a hunting law comes up in a vote or something, they come up with a negative response to it. But I also think that is on them and their mentality. I mean, you do your research, you do your homework, you go out there and you find out, hey, this isn't for me, then, I mean, you sell your equipment and you move on. But that isn't necessarily the case with everybody. I think that there's the guys that do hear it and they hear those podcasts and they do their proper research. They do watch videos, listen to podcasts, and they try and get an understanding so that they can be good at what they're investing a lot of money into. The guys that go out there and just throw their money in and roll with it, and then end up not liking it because they know nothing. They go out there and they find out it's a lot harder than it looks and it's a lot harder than it sounds. Definitely bring a level of dissatisfaction to it. And I guess what I'm getting at is that I think that the positives could definitely outweigh the negatives, but you got to have the drive and you got to have the heart to stick with it if you're going to start.
Mm-hmm. No, I totally agree. And this is where, like, when we had our conversation, that, like, I kind of was changing my opinion a little bit, that no matter what, as a responsible person, you should do your due diligence in researching equipment, understanding what it takes to kill a deer with a bow, understanding where deer live, that kind of stuff. But in the same aspect, it's like, this is probably a terrible analogy, but if it's a terrible analogy in the fact that, like, it's mind blowing. Anyway, so if I listen to a podcast that's like, oh, dude, I'm going to go spearfishing in the Keys of Florida, and it sounds awesome, but all you need is a spear gun and some flippers to get started, which hunting is kind of like that, but you don't, having not even a linking thought of what it's actually like, not understanding that when you shoot fish, they bleed, you attract sharks, you attract barracudas, the whole diving thing, potentially what the water's like, whatever. I mean, I'm not a spear gun fisherman, but I'm trying to portray, like, the dangers and the difficulties of something that, for me to just pick up, which I think a lot of people are doing, in my opinion, it's completely asinine. That was a weird rant. Sorry.
Yeah, no, I understand the analogy you were trying to make there, and I do agree with that. Like, they see the outside pictures, the general gist, and don't necessarily see the, for a lack of a better word, the barbaric side of hunting.
Like, right.
Yeah, it is very, you're killing something, right? So there's going to be blood. The gutting process is not pretty. The butchering process is not pretty to most people, and they don't necessarily have a full view of what they're getting into when they decide to get into it, when they are seeing it from the point of view of like a podcast, and they're seeing the glorious side of it, not necessarily seeing the barbaric side of it. Meat Eater does do a relatively good job, though, with his show, showing the gutting and showing the cleaning. So I think that's also an important aspect to add, so that people see that side of it and they know if they're built for it or not.
Yeah, he does do a decent job as far as his show, as showcasing it in a way, and like the whole locavore movement of sustainable food and organically harvested, if you will, where it's not so much on like the trophy and the pursuit of the animal, but the end result. So I do give him props there for sure. My gripe is potentially with the podcast and some of the print media that he's putting out, as well as the Joe Rogan podcast, and how he shed some of the light of hunting and the perception of it. But in also Joe's defense, he had Aaron Snyder on, who's one of the most realist hunters, if you will, has a ton of knowledge about hunting, paints a picture the way it should be painted, and is a role model for a lot of people, and takes them through A to Z, and doesn't really leave anything out.
Yeah, I do agree with that. And yeah, I guess basically what you're saying is you don't necessarily agree with the Instagram quote unquote celebrity hunters and the podcasters that only talk about the highs of the highs in hunting and draw people in that way. But then those people don't necessarily have that full picture painted for them.
Yes, yes. So yeah. I mean, you're pretty much hitting the nail on the head just about. I don't like the way that hunting is portrayed in to the masses of America in a way that they can't hunt that way. So for example, Joe Rogan hunting on a ranch that an elk tag cost $100,000 to get. Okay. When you have that type of experience and you're talking about elk bugling their heads off, screaming all day long, nonstop chasing cows around, blah, blah, blah. Like, that's something that you don't get on public land very often in Idaho, Colorado, Montana, so on and so forth. So
yeah,
to paint that picture of what hunting is, because a lot of Joe Rogan's listeners, which he also has avid hunters as well, but a lot of his listeners are non-hunters. He's potentially getting them to cross over into hunting, which is great and awesome. But then you go back into exactly what I was saying before.
Right. Yeah, then they go back and they have the potential to shed a negative light on it, because it's not all that Joe Rogan said it was going to be.
Exactly. And then you have this podcast, and I'm not trying to like pump up this podcast or anything, but we had the discussion of you and just having your background. You went through the trials and tribulations and cutting your teeth on public land. You missed X amount of deer before you got your first one. It took you a while to figure out where the deer were even living. And that's really what it's about. And kind of when you talk to somebody that has like hunting experience, yeah, you didn't really have hunting experience. You like had to still kind of learn it on your own, like you and your dad, but you had your uncle, you had your grandfather. Like, imagine in a situation where it was like literally just you. And you're 100% right too. Like, you still got to do your due diligence and do your research and learn how to do it, but it's being portrayed to you that it's something that's super easy. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, I agree with that. And that does make it very, very tough growing up without anybody or entering the sport without anybody and just kind of trying to cut your teeth on your own and go out there and prove to yourself that you can do it. And you gotta have that mindset. You have to have that mindset that I'm going out there not because Joe Rogan said it was cool. I'm going out there because this sounded like it would be fun based on what I heard on this. And I'm going to go try it. And in order to succeed, I have to do that research. I have to do this or that and get out there and actually like just do it. Like, not to sound cliche, but you have to have the drive. And if you go in there without the drive, like, you spend thousands of dollars on gear and you're not fully committed, you're wasting your time.
Let me ask you this. How would you go about introducing or just having a conversation with somebody that's never hunted before, has only ever heard of like or seen hunting on the movies? How would you go about potentially recruiting them to get into hunting? Like, how would you paint the picture of what hunting is, and but yet still put it in a way that makes them want to participate? You know what I mean? Because
right,
if you really tell people what like hunting is really like and how long it takes you to get good at it, unless you have private land, unless you got a ball and property, or you just live in a really good area, it's really freaking hard.
Right.
So walk me kind of through that.
That's a tough question because, I mean, there's a number of ways that you could go about trying to recruit somebody. But in all honesty, I tell them my story. Mm. I tell them what I've done, and I just, a lot of times it gets people interested if, like, say, I'm at some sort of gathering or some sort of event, and I'm talking about hunting, and someone overhears it. And say they had never, like you said, never heard much about hunting. They've seen it in the movies, and that's about it. A lot of times, like, I will tell them about what I've done and what it is and why the sport brings me joy and why the sport, really just is tranquil being in the woods, and the solitude of it. And then also the camaraderie and the brotherhood that you have with hunting buddies that you meet along the way. I try and show them that side more so than, necessarily jump right into the killing and the gutting and the hardships of it. And then I try and, like, my buddy last two, three years ago had never even shot a bow. And so I offered for him to come over and try out shooting one of my backup bows. And he loved it. His dad never hunted. No one in his family ever hunted. He had shot some guns before, like, for fun, but he had absolutely zero idea about hunting at all. And so we got to shooting bows, and he started wanting to do it more often, and then he ended up buying one. And he got pretty good at shooting a bow. And then he was like, I've been doing all this practicing. I've been doing all this shooting. Like, I kind of want to go out and try and kill a deer. And just like prove to myself that I'm good at this archery thing. And then he wanted to add the next element of it. So I kind of try with new people, like, take it in stride as far as instead of just hitting them with the whole thing all at once, take it in like bits and pieces and continue that conversation on over time. I've gotten people's phone numbers before and talked to them and encouraged them and shared personal experiences from the woods and just doing small things to kind of try and pique people's interest versus like just hitting them with the whole thing at once and overwhelming them with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think for recruitment, you need to find what's really like what you're really passionate about as far as a particular subject of like hunting. So like my two like real big things that I'm passionate about is fine dining wild game and then chasing the most mature animal that I can find and then just doing that chess match. So I'm 100% okay with eating tag soup, like as far as my buck tag goes, because I just enjoy chasing like a handful of bucks all season long and maybe only getting 1 to 3 chances of a shot at a particular deer that I'm hunting. That's what I like about that side of things. Now, the flip side of it is I'll stack those up all day long. Like 2 years ago, before I went to the stupid stick bow, we'd put 6 does in the freezer. My fiance and I and my family, we'd eat them all. But and like my big thing that I do is like I love cooking wild game in a way that like for a person that's like never had it or is like kind of has like a disposition towards wild game and they're just like, holy shit, that was delicious. I didn't know it could taste like that. That's what I'm really passionate about. And like kind of how you show the camaraderie side of things and like the tranquility. It's like the same thing, but for me, it's with like cooking. That's how I get like new people into it.
Yep. Yeah. That's definitely a good point. And that's something that I enjoy too. Like I don't get super in depth with cooking just because like right now at this stage of my life, I don't have a ton of time to dedicate towards getting like being a really good cook. And I certainly enjoy wild game, but I'm pretty basic when it comes to the cooking side of things, like your general, your steak, your burger, your summer sausage, and like jerky here and there. But I definitely agree with, introducing people to wild game and trying to change that mindset that they have, because like people that tell me that they don't like venison, my immediate response is you haven't had it cooked right.
Mm-hmm.
And then that kind of does open that door to, oh, maybe it's not so bad. So then they try some that myself or someone else has prepared and they change their mind on it, or maybe they don't. But a lot of times people end up changing their mind on it and saying it wasn't as bad as I thought it was. And then, yeah, I mean, that could definitely open a door to somebody being interested in trying to fill their own freezer.
Right. Right. And at the very least, you've now converted that person, in my opinion, I feel like you've converted that person from a person that didn't care about hunting or like wasn't an anti-hunter, but wasn't quite a, just like a non-hunter. Like they're like, wild game sucks. Like what's the point of killing animals if you're not going to eat it? The meat sucks anyway. You've then showed them that it doesn't suck. And then they're like, well, there's actually some validity to this. This makes sense. I'll support it, but I might not hunt, but I'll support it.
Right. Right. And that can also go along with you preparing them food and then them changing their mind on it. And they could also see that, like, you're using this for sustenance, like for your family and for yourself.
100%.
And they, like I shot 5 deer last year and that will keep my freezer full and keep us fed until the next deer season rolls around. Like 4 to 5 deer has been an average every year as far as, keeping the freezer full of red meat at least.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't buy beef. I don't buy pork really even. And I, I live off venison when I have red meat. And once you get past that initial investment stage of buying your gear, and I mean, the big fad right now is to keep up with the Joneses. And I feel like that's been kind of a long time running so far. People think they need new stuff every year. They need the best of the best, when, I mean, you can go to Goodwill and you can buy camo and you can get a bow off of Craigslist and you can have less than $500 into it. And that bow from 15, 20 years ago is still going to kill deer just as dead as a bow from 2021.
Right.
And so the newcomers don't necessarily have to spend thousands of dollars on stuff. But once you get past that initial investment of having the gear to do it, it really is relatively cheap as far as keeping meat in the freezer. You got the cost of the tag, and basically if you process it yourself, you obviously save a lot of money, but you got the cost of the tag invested in it, and then maybe some processing, and processing around me is about $100 per gear.
For the whole thing?
Yeah.
Like, out the door, like your whole year's done, like you're getting it back for $100.
Yeah.
Holy crap, that's cheap.
Yeah, there's a meat processing plant. Well, not meat processing. There's a deer processor right up the road from me, and he charges $100 for the deer, your general cuts, your roast, your steaks, and your burger. And he charges a premium if you want beef fat added into your burger or whatever. But if you just want your burger, your roast, and your steaks, it's $100 flat rate, and wow, you're done. And so for me, a tag in Michigan is $20 per tag. And so I got $120 and some gas money wrapped up into killing this deer after I've made that initial investment of getting my equipment. And nowhere in the world are you going to find like 35 to 40 pounds of meat for less than that.
Yeah. Yeah, no, when people try to say that, like, well, when you look at how much this steak really costs, like, you could be buying filet mignon for whatever. That's all bull crap. Like, it all depends on what you are investing into it. Like, it's like you said, you can buy, like, even if you don't buy, like, a 20-year-old bow, which you can 100% do, but, like, you can go on the used market and you can find a bow from 5 years ago for $200 to $300.
Exactly. And I know a lot about that as well. I buy and sell used bows, and my main mission with buying and selling used bows is selling that used bow to a first time hunter.
Mm-hmm.
And I sold 18 bows last summer. This summer's not over, and I don't know what I'm at right now, but I sold 18 bows last summer, and I'd say 70% of those were to first-time deer hunters.
Wow, that's awesome.
And I took the time with them when they came here. We have a bow press in the house, and we have a little kind of hillbilly-ish range set up in the house to paper tune and get the bow shooting perfect before they leave. I teach them form. I teach them draw. I teach them how to aim, how to grip the bow. And then I help them sight it in from 20 to 30 yards before they leave. And I feel like that has a positive impact on somebody's first archery experience. And it's something that I'm passionate about. I'm very passionate about archery, and I'm very passionate about hunting and getting people into hunting. But the gist of this podcast, like, I don't want somebody to have a sour taste in their mouth from their first bow hunt or their first experience even with archery. Because if they have a negative experience somewhere, say an archery shop, and they get a bow set up completely wrong and they can't hit the broadside of a barn with it when they get home, and they're thinking it's them, but in reality it's the bow, that right there could be their first initial negative introduction to hunting, even just getting their gear set up incorrectly. And I think that's just as important as doing your research and getting out there, is to have the proper gear and the proper setup.
So I think you are 100% right. And I'm really curious, because I look back on when I got into archery hunting and I didn't know shit about tuning a bow. And where I'm at now is like leaps and bounds. And I had no clue how much my accuracy depended on a properly tuned bow, on properly spined arrows, on good arrow flight as far as penetration, even in the deer if you were able to hit it. So, like, how many people that are getting into archery, because, I mean, archery's, there's, in most cases, I shouldn't say in most cases, but in a lot of cases, there's almost more archery hunters than there are rifle hunters. Like, I don't know how it is for you in Michigan, but, like, our bow hunting sales are through the roof here in PA, and it used to be the exact opposite.
Yeah, I agree with that as well, and that is basically the same story as what we got here in Michigan. My roommate actually works at the bow shop that's a mile and a half from the house, and they can't keep bows on the shelf. Mm-hmm. People are coming in and they're selling like hotcakes. So yeah, it's a very, very similar situation in that aspect.
So, like, again, this kind of goes like back to like, you don't know what you don't know, but if I was going to get into bow hunting for the first time, I can guarantee that I would go through almost the exact same process. Maybe it's a little different now because the age of technology and how information is spread is so much wider and faster than it was when I first got into archery. And it's easier to kind of find like, hey, you need to tune a bow. Hey, you need to blah, blah, blah. Maybe it's easier for a new person to pick up on that, but like I still feel like there's a huge mountain to climb, and if you're a person that you're directly contributing to getting new hunters into the sport, and you're not kind of laying the groundwork or at least pointing them in the right direction, that's not cool, man.
Right, yeah. And I feel like it needs to be made known that if you're trying to get into archery, you need to have a good bow shop, a reputable bow shop to go to walk you through those intro steps. You can't just buy a bow off of eBay and slap a rest on it and order some Amazon Chinese arrows and start sending them down range. I mean, that's just downright dangerous.
Do you think a lot of people think that, though, that get their first bow?
I do. Actually, I've experienced it. One of the used bows that I bought last summer was from a guy that bought his very first bow off of eBay, and he bought some severely underspined arrows off of Amazon. And I mean, these things, you could take this arrow in one hand and put it between your fingers and flex the shit out of it.
Wow.
And I was like, dude, I'm very thankful that you did not break this arrow when you release the bow and send it through your hand. I mean, I think we've all seen pictures like that on the internet floating around. Because I mean, it was a downright dangerous situation, and I took those arrows after I bought the bow from him and I threw it in the trash. I made sure that he understood what I was saying before I bought the bow from him, and he had no interest in keeping it because he couldn't shoot it. And so, yeah, I mean, just an example like that is, I believe it's a far more common thing than most people think.
What do you think about the inaccurate information being spread across the interweb and platforms where people are just trying to spew out information to get people to listen to their platform or whatever. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. And it makes me cringe every time. I'm in a relatively large bow hunting group. on Facebook, and it makes me cringe every time I read somebody posting asking for advice and just the myriad of different answers you get from people that are 90% of them are incorrect.
Mm-hmm.
Just last week, I was reading through a comment section on somebody asking for advice on arrow squatting and or on arrow weight, and everybody was telling them that the spine number on the side of the arrow was the weight.
Wow.
And just strictly that information right there, someone say they want a 550 grain arrow, and they go out and buy a 500 spine arrow, and they're shooting it out of a 70-pound bow. I mean, that's just downright dangerous.
Yeah. And I don't want this podcast to sound like a kind of bashing on people in hunting and it's like, it's almost like kind of like a social media bash, if you will. It's not that, like, I think hunters are, one, stupid, and then two, trying to do the wrong thing. Like, I do think that, like, yeah, that person that said that the spine was the weight, he was trying to help that person. He was just misinformed. So his intentions were good, but
I agree with that.
He was just wrong, and he had to have learned that from somewhere else. So, like, it kind of just trickles down and trickles down and trickles down, but in today's day and age, like, everybody has a voice because of social media. I mean, heck, you and I are talking, and this is going to be heard by who knows how many people. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that, like, the big thing, like, yeah, we're not on this podcast trying to bash people or trying to paint this in a negative light. We're just trying to bring to the person that's new to this, we're trying to bring it to their attention to make sure that you have a reputable source that you're getting your information from. And I mean, there's a lot of good people on Facebook and on Instagram and on YouTube. I mean, like, the biggest thing that I tell everybody when they're asking for information on archery stuff, like, where can I go to learn? A lot of times, like, someone at a bow shop isn't going to have 3 hours to dedicate to tell you all about this stuff.
Right.
But on YouTube, I am a very big fan of John Dudley's School of Knock. When that comes down to intro to archery, like, that guy did it right.
I've heard that a lot. I've heard that a lot about John Dudley's School of Knock and how well that was put together for introduction to archery.
Yeah, it was done very well, and I recommend everybody. I mean, even if you've been bow hunting for 10 years and you think you know everything you need to know, I mean, there's things that he's going to bring to light that you might not have ever heard of.
If you were going to make a recommendation to a person seeking information, how would you, or what would you say to them as far as filtering and sifting through information? Or would you just say fact check it?
Fact checking is definitely very wishy-washy, if you ask me. I mean, you got all these ads on Facebook for things that aren't hunting related or whatever, but you got the thing underneath it that says this has been fact checked to be incorrect.
Yeah.
When a lot of that is media driven. I think fact checking can be a useful tool, but it also is not right a lot of times. When people are trying to sift through information, a lot of times I tell them to go to, like, say for arrow spine or weight, Easton has a pretty good description of what you need to look for your arrow spine on their website. Like, go to a manufacturer's website and learn directly from that manufacturer what you need to know. Or if you read something in an article that you have questions about, look it up on a manufacturer's website. There's not a lot of things that manufacturers necessarily leave out when it comes to archery stuff. So as long as you can back up what you hear, then I think that you are in a relatively safe boat as far as trying to avoid the misinformation.
That's a really good point, and something I've actually never considered or even never said to anybody. But if you have questions, call the manufacturer. I would say 9 times out of 10, they're going to be correct and they're going to give you honest information. Yeah, they might try to sell you on their products, but you can always say no, go back, and then research other products and compare and contrast to see which one's better, which one fits your budget more, so on and so forth. But yeah, don't be that's pretty much the big point, is don't be afraid to ask questions. And then, like Adam's saying, like, do your due diligence into fact-checking it yourself, either through the manufacturer's guidelines or asking questions to somebody that you hopefully find reputable.
Yeah, I concur.
So, I had another thought here, but I completely just had it leave my mind. You have anything else that you want to kind of ramble on about? We're getting close to the hour mark. I've been getting hassled that my podcasts are getting a little long winded.
Yep. Yeah. So basically, like, just kind of like a recap. Like, I don't think that this podcast was meant to bash on people for trying to get into hunting. It definitely was not. It was supposed to be sort of a encouragement towards, if you want to do this, do it, but get out there and do it. Like, do your research, learn. Don't just go out there and wing it, because the people that wing it are the ones that are going to bring that negative light, are going to have the bad experience with it, versus doing your due diligence and getting your information from a reputable source, somewhere that will give you the correct information and not mislead you as far as products. And a lot of products on the market are fads, and you don't need this gadget and this gadget to be a successful hunter. But it's not going to be easy getting into it. It's definitely not going to be a walk through the park or a hike through the woods. I mean, it's going to be work. And the aftermath after you kill a deer is going to be, I mean, it's not pretty. I mean, there's definitely things that some people wouldn't be able to stomach. And you have to mentally prepare yourself for that. And just do your research and get out there, because there's not really a better teacher than experience. Get out there and do it, or get on a forum and ask somebody to mentor you. There's tons and tons of guys like myself that will actually take the time and teach you things, whether it's over the phone or over Instagram or Facebook, or if you're close enough, like within reason, meet up with you and go over things and teach you some things. Like we talked about social media as kind of a negative in this, and the spread of misinformation as far as the hunting world goes, but there is a lot of positives that can come through it. You have the world at your fingertips, and sure, you might not know anybody that deer hunts or that is into hunting, and you can put a post on a hunting forum or on Facebook, and you could find out that the neighbor 2 houses down from you bow hunts, or he's a deer hunter, and he's willing to teach you some things.
Yeah, without a doubt. And kind of just to piggyback off of Adam here, it's like, take the initiative, and just don't be scared. Don't be scared that you're going to ask a stupid question. Like, if you're looking for a mentor, any mentor that's going to be worth a damn is going to handle that the correct way. There are no stupid questions. We've all been in that situation where we've more than likely probably ask the exact same question that you're going to ask too. So that's one of the things that I run across all the time, is like people are scared of just getting bashed and beaten down for asking a question because they think they might sound stupid, or in the past people have just lit them up. We've all been there. Like, we've all asked those same questions, and the people that are doing the bashing, screw them. It doesn't even matter.
Yep. Yeah. You can weed out the negative comments, and you don't have to take those to heart. You can definitely, there's no stupid questions when it comes to it. I mean, there might be redundant questions that other people have asked on the same forum, but I mean, a lot of forums, even Facebook, like you're in a bow hunting group or a deer hunting group, you can use the search bar within that group to search for a question, and it'll pull up other questions with the keywords that you type in to search for. And a lot of times you can get your questions answered that way before being redundant and asking the question that somebody asked 2 days ago.
It's a valid point. It's a valid point. Well, Adam, any closing thoughts? Anything else that you potentially want to touch on here real quick before we wrap up?
Oh, I think that's really pretty much most of what we had to talk about. So I appreciate you having me on and going over some of this stuff. And I certainly hope that it doesn't dissuade new hunters from doing it, but it mentally prepares them to know that it's going to be difficult and it's going to be a fun ride as long as you stick with it and you you have that drive.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And like we said before when we were talking over Instagram, like, I feel like this is a conversation that people need to have and people need to hear so that they're not misinformed and they don't have this misconception. And then the flip side of things is that there's actually ways to go out there and be successful just by finding a mentor or asking questions. But Adam, if anybody wants to reach out to you and bounce some questions off of you, just get in contact with you, that kind of thing, what's your social media, how they can get in contact with you?
I would say probably the best way would be through Instagram. My handle on Instagram will be _AReader and then another _. And then Facebook as well. My name's just Adam Reader on Facebook. But preferably Instagram would be the best way to contact me.
Okay. I'll throw your Instagram handle in the show notes. I'll have a link for it. So if any listeners want to bounce some questions, get some advice from Adam, maybe they're out in Michigan, maybe you're somewhere in the Midwest and you need some pointers, especially archery stuff, get in contact with him. Definitely don't hesitate to do that. Adam's a super cool dude, and I really appreciate you hopping on the podcast, Adam.
Yeah, I definitely appreciate you having me, and like you said, feel free to reach out, guys. I'll try and answer to the best of my ability, and I travel a lot, so yeah, feel free to reach out anytime.
Yeah, we'll have to get a part two going once the season kicks off. And what's speaking of which, like, let's continue this here a little bit real quick. What hunts do you have planned this year?
I'm kind of like on the fence right now about going to Colorado to elk hunt. I had my transmission go out in my truck about 3 weeks ago, and so that kind of drained some money that I wasn't expecting to spend. But I'll definitely be hunting all over the state of Michigan, and there's a good chance that I'll end up in Ohio during Michigan's gun season, because Ohio's archery season runs longer than Michigan's does, and so I'll probably go hunt the rut in Ohio a little bit in November. And then quite possibly doing a little bit over in Tennessee as well, because my girlfriend's in PA school there, and so I'll probably spend some time in Tennessee and bring my bow along with.
Nice. I'd love to hear about Tennessee. That's kind of been one of the states that's been on like my radar here for a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. yeah, if I get down there, I'll definitely be in touch.
Sounds good, man. All right. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in to the Whitetail Theories podcast.